Our planet is a lonely speck in the great cosmic dark.
Hi, this is Chrissy.
And I'm Marie.
And you're listening to Alt Pop Repeat,
a show where we get into the nitty-gritty around counterculture, alternative culture, and sync it up with what?
With pop culture.
Yeah, man. That's what we do.
There we go.
High five. Yes.
Okay, I have a question for you.
Do you have a question for me?
I do, for you. If you were stuck in a bunker with five people, what type of skills would you want these people to have?
Oh, dude. Okay, easy. I would like to... Thank you for asking me this question. First of all, I'm honored. Skills. I would need somebody who has medical skills. I would need somebody who has, domestic skills, like cooking skills, repair skills. Like, somebody who is just... I need a mechanic, ideally an engineer of some degree, to fix things. I want somebody who's, like, a plant person. Like, I want them to be able to grow things. So I need somebody who can, that's four. Yeah, like I'll take a botanist.
Yeah.
So I have medical. I have just like a general like person that translates, like they can cook, they can fix like the little, just domestic fixin', which I think is important. Then, and then I have my domestic, and then I have my engineer, my botanist. Oh, I need a fifth. The fifth is me.
fair enough.
I mean, really, like I have this and then I have all those people. Like, what else do I need? We've got our mechanic, our engineer is able to create solar energy or create wind turbines. Then I have my medical person keeps me alive so that I can enjoy, somebody who cooks for me that makes me and cleans.
So all it is for people that can help Marie with stuff.
Yeah, I'm picking five people. I want to be in a...
So who's the boss of the... Obviously, you are the CEO of the bunker.
Obviously, I'm the CEO of the bunker. Why? Because I'm hot and all of these men want to service me.
That's fair too.
Right?
That's 100% fair.
So I'm thinking...
Can I be in the bunker by you?
Of course. We're going to have adjacent bunkers.
Perfect.
We're going to have that door that they have like in
the
hotel
secret
rooms.
A secret door?
Yeah, we'll have a secret door. One, we have to have a secret door.
A secret bunker door.
And a secret escape, just in case our slaves decide to revolt. Sex slaves. And then we have... But there's like that door like they have in the hotel rooms when they have the two rooms. You know,
right.
The two...
Right.
That's what we're going to have.
Yeah, exactly. But it'll be our secret.
So we can
a secret bunker door.
That's what we're going
to
do.
So my next question is, if you had to bring five items with you during Armageddon and you had to go to a bunker, what would the five items be?
Five items. I would bring with me food. I'm counting. I can count food as an item, right? Like...
Yeah, I guess why not? But, an item is like an item of food. You only get five things. So you've been like one can of food. It's an item because items are like...
Cyanide, because we're all going to die. I can only bring... I have five people I need to feed in this bunker. I am the CEO of the bunker and I can only bring in one can of food. Otherwise, then it would be five...
Well, you have five items. So the one item would be food. Okay, there you go. Okay, what's one?
Seeds.
Yeah.
I'd bring a UV light or something to be able, because I'm assuming my bunker is underground. So I need something, some light source to be able to grow the seeds and stuff with.
Yeah.
I would have water.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I would bring some like flint or something that I could create like fire with.
In the bunker?
Yeah, why not? Let's all die of asphyxiation. We're already like
carbon monoxide at its best.
Yeah, why not? Let's just...
Okay, so that's five?
That's four.
That's four.
And then a sex slave. I don't know. But the fifth one, I can't think of something. I can't. Fifth, like blankets? I don't know.
Blankets. I don't even know what I would bring. First aid kit. Water. Great.
Oh, wait. Hold on.
GPS cell phone thing that maybe I could use the bunker, but again, if a bunker's underground, some bunkers aren't underground.
GPS needs...
Does GPS work through concrete?
Yeah, no.
Shit. So, some form of communication tool, like Morse code, maybe something like that. That would still work.
Over the air, through the waves.
Exactly.
The first time ever.
And then some kind of communications tool. What is that? Is that three things right now?
You can have, I would say get yourself a radio, like a shh.
Yep.
10-4, 10-4.
There you go. A walkie-talkie.
No, like a trucker radio. What are they called? Like an AB.
Right. I don't know what those are called though.
Yeah, like
10-4, big even rig, out, Steve.
Big rig baby.
Yeah.
Coming in hot.
That's what I'm gonna call you now, big rig baby.
I don't like that nickname. So we have five people in the bunker. Each one of those five people, can they bring five things? Because if that's the case, then my medical expert, I'm expecting him to bring in like all of the first aid equipment.
Why not? It's our bunker.
The fish medication.
Yeah.
Whatever. And then like the engineer, I want them to bring in all the things that they need. The botanist needs to bring in the UV lights, the engineering.
That's smart. So depending on your craft, you bring in five items associated with it.
And
smart.
Then we all bring in my items.
Maybe you should be the CEO of the bunker.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, why is it my responsibility to bring five things that are going to supply all of you? You need to bring something to the table. Besides the fact that this is all, obviously it's a sexual exchange. I get it. That's why I'm the CEO. But you got to bring something to the table. And also like if we have adjacent doors.
Yep.
Then I have my five. You can bring your five in.
Perfect.
And then we can start building a real community here.
We'll have a bunker party.
We're having a bunker party. Yeah. It's kind of like there's that place that's the bunker condo.
Yeah, we'll talk about that actually, because there is a bunker community I was going to chat about in our sink. But who is our guest today, Marie?
Bradley Garrett.
Yes, a social geographer at University College Dublin and the author of Bunker Building for End Times.
You don't scoop the lead.
That's true. So I say, let's roll into the interview, and in the end, we'll sync it up. Well, just so our listeners know, can you explain what a social and cultural geographer is? Because I don't think a lot of people understand that term and know that it's even a job.
Yeah, it's kind of a European term. So essentially, I'm a human geographer rather than a physical geographer. So physical geographers, you know, are studying rocks and rivers. I work with people, and essentially, I'm interested in how people shape their relationships to space. You know, how do people make spaces? Why are places important to them? So it's kind of like a cross section between geography and anthropology. If you can imagine that.
Awesome. How did you get into the business?
I used to be an archaeologist, actually, and this is kind of a weird story, but I wanted to do a PhD, and I went to UCLA to talk to this geographer called Dennis Cosgrove, and when I met with him, he told me, you know, you're not really an archaeologist, you're actually a human geographer, and he was from England. And he said, you know, I would love to have you as a PhD student at UCLA, but I have stomach cancer. And he said, what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to write you a letter of recommendation. I just met this guy. And he said, I'm going to write you a letter of recommendation to the University of London. And he did right there in front of me. And 3 months later, I had full funding to do a PhD. It was an incredible gift. And he passed away about 3 months into my PhD, but he just like, it's just one of those weird stories of a kind of, you know, someone who is incredibly generous, just totally changing, altering your life course in a moment. And he sent me down that path, and that was, I don't know, 15 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk a lot about prepping and who are preppers, doomsday preppers. So I know there's different groups within the prepping world. Can you break down those subgroups within that subculture?
Yeah, it's really tricky to break down because it's not a coherent group of people in any way, shape, or form. But you know, because I'm a geographer and I'm interested in how people are shaping spaces, I was interested in finding preppers who had totally different methodologies. But similar ideas about why they needed to prepare for disasters in the future. So I spent time with people who, kind of the people you might expect to run into from traditional media narratives, you know, who are building these multi-million dollar bunkers with nuclear, biological and chemical air filtration systems, you know, with 25-year canned food stacked to the ceiling, lots of guns, you know, heavy concrete subterranean bunkers. And often those people were either ex-military or defense contractors who had sort of, you know, been indoctrinated through their own experiences into thinking that like the world is just a chaotic mess and they needed to build a citadel to protect themselves from it. But I also ran into people who were going off grid, people who were sort of, you know, breaking away from society and becoming more self-sufficient, installing solar panels, growing their own food, canning, hunting, weaving, crafting. I met people who had built sort of ranches and they wanted to raise animals and create a sort of fort, but for a community of people. And I met people in urban areas who didn't have a lot of space and were literally just, you know, filling their apartment under their beds and in their closets with generators and food, you know, just to give themselves a little bit more resiliency in the face of a disaster, whether that is like a blackout for a couple of days or full-scale civil war, which we might be on the verge of right now.
Seriously.
Oh my.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't want to go there.
No,
so
soon, I have questions around that, so don't worry.
It's been a hot I mean, it's been on everyone's tongues since it happened. It's in absolutely crazy town. But yeah, when you're looking at it, you're going, hey, is this the end of days? Like, we're going through a pandemic. There's insurgencies happening with people like running on the Capitol Hill. People are dying in Capitol Hill. Like, I don't understand what's going on in this world. I think I might get a bunker. That's kind of how this is all netting out.
Well, so the bunker is kind of interesting, right? Because these are again, different methodologies for the same concerns, right? And one of the things that's been really clear as we've move through this pandemic is that what we really need is like mental fortitude and stamina to get through this. That even if you had a space, even if you spent, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 building a bunker that was stockpiled with 3 months of food, you would have had to come out in month three of the pandemic and go to the grocery store, you know? And if, I mean, which is fine in this case, but if the fatality rate was like 10% in this pandemic, that would have been, you know, you just buy yourself a little bit of time. You don't necessarily escape the disaster. So I don't know. I feel like the bunker, I mean, it depends on what you're preparing for, but the bunker in many instances is the wrong answer to the problem. You know, what we really need is to get away from people, right? To just like get a remote property, get out of cities. And that's happening right now. I mean, people are moving out of cities in record numbers. I read a survey recently that 40% of people that live in major cities in the US had considered relocating to a remote property. And obviously this is being enabled by the fact that people are can do remote work. The remote work that, of course, we were told a year ago wasn't possible. You know, we had to show up to the office every day. And now it's like, oh, no, we didn't. That whole thing was a fiction. And obviously this isn't everyone's reality. You know, a lot of people are suffering, they're stuck, they can't leave densely populated areas, they live in multifamily households, you know, and for them, this is a very different experience. But a lot of people are really taking seriously the idea that they're going to leave urban areas. Social scientists are actually calling it, there's a name for it, COVID flight. People are leaving cities in record numbers, and it's gonna reshape geography. I mean, the preppers told me, 3 years ago when I began this project, one of the first things they said to me is that a disaster isn't necessarily a horrible thing, right? Like, you know, the word apocalypton from Greek means renewal, right? Like a disaster can be a chance to kind of reshape things, to rethink things. It's a moment of rebirth as well as death, right? So we're going through that right now. It feels like we're going through a social, cultural, political rebirth, and it's painful, and it's horrible, but we're emerging now into something else, something new. And in many ways it looks, more equal, more fair, potentially, you know, like things seem like they're heading in a good direction. And I guess one of the questions that we'll never be able to answer, one of those haunting what ifs, is like, would this have happened without the pandemic? You know?
Well, very true. And Robert McFaulin, who's an author that did a quote and said that after reading your book, and said that it was a study of fear and privilege in apocalypse. When we're looking at society, do you think that preppers are like a reflection of our societal issues then that have happened over the course of time? Like, are they just reflecting back to us and, you know, or projecting, maybe that's a better word, projecting back to us the fears and privilege and everything else that we have? Because you really is a privilege to be a prepper, I would say, too. So
no, it certainly is. You have to have the resources, you have to have the space, you have to have the time.
Yeah.
But my interest in preppers was always twofold. I mean, I was interested in them as individuals, who they are, what their concerns were, what they were building. But I was also interested in exactly what you say, that they were a mirror reflecting the anxieties that we were all feeling as a culture, right? When you see that many people stockpiling supplies, leaving cities, building bunkers, right? It's obvious that there's something terrible is going on in the background, right? There's this kind of undercurrent, this electric undercurrent, right? That is like charging all of this activity. And being a previous archaeologist, I always look to the past too. And I think, you know, if you look at a society that is in collapse in the archaeological record, what do you find? Do you find people moving high up into the cliffs and building citadels? You find people building walls, you know, you find archaeological traces that indicate that something was going terribly wrong. Either, you know, the environment was collapsing, or these people were at war, or there was disease ravaging them. And that's precisely what is being created right now. So 100 years in the future, somebody is going to look back at these archaeological traces, and they're going to see it. They're going to see a material record of civil unrest, of the pandemic, of frustration, of economic collapse. You know, it's all going to be there. This is another kind of privilege, is to sort of like live through this time and be, I mean, I feel incredibly privileged to be one of the storytellers, to sort of pass on these stories to future generations. Whether they'll exist is another question, right? Depending on how bad things get. But I do have hope, like all of the preppers, because there's no point in prepping, and there's no point in writing the book unless you believe that there is a future and people are gonna read it and people are gonna be there.
This is a loaded question. Okay. I've got two questions, but I'll save the other one because that's actually, I feel like, a bit more legitimate. But of all the people that are prepping, and they're the ones that are with hope, fingers crossed, that they will survive, get to the other side of whatever terrible thing befalls us as a humanity. Should we be concerned that they're the ones that might start the next civilization, that these are all of our Adam and Eves, these inherently fearful individuals with PTSD? Like, should average everyday people be prepping as well?
But at least, you know, they have hope.
They've got hope, but I don't know. I have, because my limited knowledge of it is I'm thinking of these individuals, and they're scared. They have this sense that the doomsday is coming and they want to survive it. Therefore, they're going to create whatever their end of day scenario is going to be, how they're going to survive it. And at the same time, in the back of my head, I'm thinking these people are not necessarily like level-headed. I don't know. Is there a euphemism for saying it? I think they're kind of crazy.
You know, this is a totally fascinating question. And I guess my first response, again, you know, thinking as an archaeologist, is that we are all the byproduct of this kind of thinking. Like this survival instinct kicks in all human beings when we're facing extinction. And there was one point in human history where there were only about 100,000 of us left on Earth. And it was only because people, you know, moved out of cold climates and migrated and explored and colonized new territories that our species survived at all. And it was because that survival instinct kicked in. So, you know, it's also a question about kind of parenting, you know, because if your parents are like hardcore preppers and they survive this apocalypse, your kids are most likely to be the antithesis of you. You know, they're probably gonna be like very, very hopeful, liberal, happy people. But I don't know, you know, does it take a sense of pessimism to prep, or can we prep from a space of hope? I guess that's the question that I always come back to, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we can prep in a space of hope.
One of the things that really surprised me when I spent time in these prepper communities is that when I pose this question to them, like, is what you're doing, is it not selfish, right? Like, you've built a space for yourself and your family and maybe your friends, but at some point you're going to close that door and you're going to preserve your life, and potentially you will be able to, you know, continue to exist and propagate and enjoy the world, and you're going to leave everyone else behind. And often the response, again, which really surprised me, is people said, no, that's not what we're doing at all. We wouldn't close the door to people. And in fact, what we're trying to do is to build up some personal resiliency so that we can take some of the strain off of systems, off of infrastructural systems, you know. So they said, at the beginning of the pandemic, one of the communities that I had worked with in South Dakota, this sort of amazing series of concrete igloos, these semi-subterranean bunkers, or 575 bunkers, three quarters the size of Manhattan, a massive space. They all went back to the bunkers at the beginning of the pandemic. And they had food and they had all their supplies. And I called them kind of expecting them to be smug, like, you know, we've been vindicated. The thing finally happened. And one of the preppers told me, he said, you know, I feel bad for people who haven't prepared, but the fact of the matter is, I'm not going to end up on a respirator. I don't have to go to the grocery store. I'm not going to put strain on frontline workers. I have my own PPE. I'm prepared for the situation. And I've done that not necessarily just for myself, but for society. It's like a gift. Like, I had the resources to do this, and instead of buying an RV, I invested it in taking strain off of the system during a disaster. And that's exactly what we're doing right now, as are these other 40 families who are in the bunkers. And that really surprised me, you know, that they saw it as kind of altruistic, you know, a gift to society rather than something selfish.
Yeah. And it makes sense. That kind of makes sense too. I think both ways do. And I think it just depends on how you see the world. Do you get a lot of preppers that believe strongly in folklore or stories like the Georgia Guidestones? The reason why I ask that, because the Georgia Guidestones are one of those things that I would imagine a prepper would kind of be like a gospel for them, that there's only going to be like X 100,000 people left on the planet. Do you find that people that in a mentality with prepping kind of fall very closely and follow folklore or any of those kind of stories?
Yeah. I guess if you are speculating on the future, it's very easy to cross over that line from sort of like garnering scientific evidence about probable scenarios to tipping into the kind of realm of mythology and the spiritual, or even the conspiratorial. You know, I spoke to a lot of people who are, you know, they're open, they're receptive to all sorts of theories about what could happen. And they don't necessarily buy into them, but they just sort of add them to the kind of quiver, you know, of things that could go wrong. And so most people that are prepping aren't prepping for a specific thing. They're not prepping for a pandemic or a nuclear war or civil war or whatever. They're prepping for all of it. And so I guess if, yeah, you know, if you're open and receptive to these kind of other interpretations about what might happen, whether they be mythological, biblical, whatever, then you just sort of add that into the pot and you start prepping for those things as well. Most people, when I kind of really interrogated them on those things that I found a little outlandish, you know, they would falter, and they would tend to fall back on what they felt like were more obvious or potential disasters. The most disturbing of which, I have to say, is an electromagnetic pulse. Have you looked at those?
No. What's that one?
Okay, so check this out. There, in I think it was 1958. No, 1858. There was a mass coronal ejection from the sun. A coronal mass ejection, a CME. So it's basically like a giant solar burp from the sun. And these happen all the time, right? And this is where the Borealis comes from, the Northern Lights, right? It's actually a solar flare that's hitting the ionosphere and magnetizing the atmosphere, and those are the lights we see. Well, in 1858, we had a major one called the Carrington event. And when it happened, it fried telegraph lines across Canada. People in Jamaica were seeing the Borealis. It was an incredibly severe solar flare, CME. And apparently these happen pretty regularly. If you look at if you look through historical records, it's like every 150 years or so, we get one of these kind of major, you know, it's a cyclical event. It's pretty regular. The problem is that 150 years ago, we didn't have all of these fragile electronics, electrical systems, infrastructural systems, data servers, the internet, and all of these things could be potentially interrupted by a massive solar flare. And so a lot of preppers told me that that they spent a lot of their time trying to figure out how they're going to live without electricity, without phones, without computers, without technology. And that's one of those things that I think most of us have a really hard time getting our heads around. And the pandemic has made that so much worse, right? Because we've become hyper dependent on all of this technology, right? If all of this disappeared, there's no more Zoom, there's no more calling anyone, like, what would we do? You know, I mean, everything would just descend into sort of tribalism again. It would take so long to rebuild.
Yeah, it takes so long. You'd have to go back to the community mentality, which I don't think is a bad thing. But
you know, I don't think so. I don't think so either. And then the question is, where are you when this happens? You know, that becomes really important. And everyone you ask says the same thing. I want to be at home. You know,
everybody wants to be home.
Yeah.
But you can't control that.
I don't want to be out in the street where everybody's confused and the street lights aren't working and people's cars are stopping in the middle of the road. But it's funny because I know my brother-in-law has kept a rotary phone because he's like, well, if everything, that's his end of days preparation.
Like now. Yeah.
He's like, I have this because then I can make calls. And I'm like, who are you going to call? So, okay, question for you about bunkers. Why do we associate bunkers with preppers? Why, how, because you've described, there's so many other types of places that people can go and retreat to. How did bunkers become like the penultimate definition for a prepper?
I think it's a kind of leftover from the Cold War, right? That people, you know, during the Cold War. So let's go back to 1956, when the Eisenhower administration built themselves a massive bunker under the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia. Nobody knew that they had built themselves a bunker. No one knew, I think, until the early 2000s, when the Washington Post revealed the existence of the bunker. But when Kennedy took power, it was obvious that there was a decision that was made at the highest levels of government that the U.S. government was not going to protect its citizens from nuclear war. And I should say that this is in contrast to the Soviet Union, where currently today there is bunker space for every single citizen in Moscow.
Wow.
right? So the US made this decision that they were just going to put the burden on individuals. You know, if you want to protect yourself and your family, you need to dig up your backyard and bury a bunker back there and protect yourselves. You know, I mean, it's a very American response to an existential threat, right? Like, yeah, that's your problem. You know, if you can't figure out how to deal with the nuclear war, well, good luck. You know, anyway, when Kennedy took power, I think he was clearly unnerved by the fact that these preparations hadn't been made at a government level. And so he gave this speech in 1961, where he said that that it was the responsibility of every family to prepare themselves. And social scientists now call this the first doom boom, because obviously, you know, as with everything in the United States, when the government doesn't fill a function, then this private market springs up. And overnight, there were all these companies building bunkers, digging up backyards. You could order bunkers through Sears catalogs, and they would arrive on a flatbed truck with an excavator, and they would bury that thing in your backyard. It was an incredible period of time, but I think that it really cemented in the American cultural psyche this association between prepping and bunker. Like, you have to have a bunker that's stockpiled with food and supplies to be able to survive. But those bunkers were a response to a singular threat. They were a response to nuclear war. And right. Of course, the threats that we face today are myriad. You know, there's so many things that you could or should or might build for. So the bunker isn't necessarily the right solution, but we're still kind of stuck on it. And as a culture, obsessed with the people who have like the most technologically advanced, sophisticated bunkers. You know, we kind of imagine them like subterranean cruise ships. Like, we're just going to be sort of like riding high, sipping champagne, watching movies, and then we'll kind of emerge 5 years later into the post-apocalyptic world where we can go like claim New Zealand or something because it's empty, you know?
Poor New Zealand. They're doing so well.
I know.
So our show today is about preppers and the subculture of preppers/survivalism.
That's it. People most like, I think in pop culture, we all know it more as the doomsday preppers. That seems to be the colloquialism that people subscribe to.
Yep.
Where it was like a show, really, of people who were preparing for the end of days. And it's like, it's a thing. It's a thing people are into. I don't know if I necessarily am like that, like of all of my fandoms of life, I just don't... It doesn't involve the end of days. My fandoms are more like Chris Evans. I'm really big into Sailor Moon and anime and food, but definitely my fandom
is not prepping.
No, I'm not like I am a fan of preparing for the end of the world.
I'm not a fan. I've thought about it multiple times.
Oh, I've thought about it too.
One of the first times in history that preppers were ever really became a thing was during the Cold War.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right? And so they had the Cold World Civil Defense Program, created like public atomic bomb shelters, fallout shelters. And they also, so we're going to go into our first sink, created a video called Duck and Cover in 1951. And this was, and they said it was, they might have been propaganda. It's actually most of the time mischaracterized as propaganda during the Cold War, but it wasn't. It was actually a full legit video that showed people how to protect themselves if an atomic bomb was going to go off. And we're going to play it right now.
Now, we must be ready for a new danger, the atomic bomb. First, you have to know what happens when an atomic bomb explodes. You will know when it comes. We hope it never comes, but we must get ready. It looks something like this. There is a bright flash, brighter than the sun, brighter than anything you've ever seen. If you are not ready and did not know what to do, it could hurt you in different ways. It could knock you down hard or throw you against a tree or a wall. It is such a big explosion, it can smash in buildings and knock signboards over and break windows all over town. But if you duck and cover like Bert, you will be much safer. You know how bad sunburn can feel. the atomic bomb flash could burn you worse than a terrible sunburn, especially where you're not covered. Now, you and I don't have shells to crawl into like Bert the Turtle, so we have to cover up in our own way. First, you duck, and then you cover. And very tightly, you cover the back of your neck and your face. Duck and cover underneath a table or desk or anything else close by.
Yeah, I know the Cold War is a major one, but how did, like, this concept of, like, underground, because they were underground bunkers in people's backyards. They're still finding them in the UK. How did that cross the pond to the United States as it being a solution to this Soviet threat?
Well, there was something that I looked up, and it's called the Voss Point, V-I-V-O-S Point. And they're abandoned off-grid former military complex. So there are these complexes that the military built that are bunkers. And bunkers have been built war times that we know. World War One and World War Two. Obviously, Germany had multiple bunkers. Hitler did. But we also have bunkers as well. But we turned those bunkers were military complex. So I don't think it's a North American slash, you know, Eastern European thing slash or European thing slash like a North American thing. I think it's just a general military complex thing that everyone does, that you build bunkers for people that are higher up. But what Voss did, what they ended up doing was taking these abandoned off-grid military complex and then making them major survivalist community. So this is like one of our other sinks, is that now these military complexes have become survival communities that you can find in the Black Hills area of South Dakota. And it sleeps, each bunker sleeps about 10 to 20 people. It has concrete walls and floors. Apparently there's 575 private military built complexes in these bunkers. And they said that you can go to your bunker whenever you want. You can go to your bunker. If you want to live there full time, you can live in your bunker. If you want to just go there on a vacation, you can go there, or you can use it for doomsday. So it's a community, but there's like nothing. There's not like stores or anything. It's just like little heaps of dirt with concrete walls. And you just drive out to your bunker in the middle of nowhere.
I think that's a really, you have to be a serious end of days enthusiast where you're like, my cottage is, like, I have less view at my vacation property as I do than in my day-to-day life.
Well, it would be a really cool hangout spot.
I mean, I would do it. For sure, I would do it. Are you kidding me? If we were like, hey, Chrissy, guess what? We got a night at the bunker. Like, yes, I would love to do that. If we could do prep for the show where we could go to the underwater hotel and say, like, this is essentially a bunker. I mean, that's protected against nuclear attack for sure. You're not nuclear. It doesn't go through water.
I would be so scared going to an underwater.
You would?
I'd be petrified. Not to a hotel. I'd be underwater bunker. The reason why is that at least with another bunker, you can dig your way out of it if you need to. Or I don't know.
Yeah, put on a swimsuit. I don't know, with concrete and you wall. Just swim out. Get your snorkel.
Yeah, well, you die trying to do that.
What? How deep are you going to go? We're not going to the bottom of the Marianas Trench here.
I think you have to go pretty deep. That's what he said.
We'd go deep enough. Oh, God, there's going to be so many horny listeners listening to be like, ooh, I'm just going to have a cut of Marie and Chrissy saying going deep. I wouldn't want to go deep. Oh, I would like to go very deep.
I would be scared that I would be in the bunker and then a small leak would start and then I'd be screaming trying to like tape up the leak and then you can't get out of your leaky bunker.
In a way.
Like you can't. Like that's petrifying.
A leaky bunker.
You can't. It's petrifying.
There is literally like, I mean, we have years of underwater technology. Look, James Cameron has his little submarine. He's gone to deeper than anyone else has gone. We've got underwater properties. There's like vacation.
Yeah, but they're not underwater bunkers. I bet you there are. We just don't.
There has to be. Oh my God!
I'll choose the underground bunker.
Underground bunker, I think, is more claustrophobic to me, but underwater bunker, that's fun. In Canada, I think it's interesting. We have the Diefenbunker.
Oh, what's the Diefenbunker?
Oh my gosh, this is one of the list of places I want to go when we go to Ottawa, is Ottawa, the capital of Canada. Also, if you know the song by Technotronic, be like, I don't want a place to stay. I always think of it as Ottawa, a place to stay. That's every time you say Ottawa, that song is playing in my head. Ottawa, the capital of Canada. There is a place we had one of our prime ministers in the Cold War era was called Diefenbaker. And so he built
the Diefenbaker bunker.
Yeah. It's a 4-story bunker in Ottawa. And now it's no longer in, being used as a military governmental.
Is it a hotel now?
Now it's a museum. So you can go explore. Ooh. The Diefenbaker. You can actually go on Google Maps right now. You can explore it. So if you live elsewhere in the world, you don't have an opportunity to go to Ottawa and explore the Diefenbaker. If you're curious on what a governmental military bunker would look like, you can go on Google Maps and you can explore it floor by floor. You can walk around through the Diefenbaker. There's no, currently some of the fun facts of it, there's no Wi-Fi in the bunker, which sucks.
There's no Wi-Fi?
Yeah.
Well, and let's be honest, you wouldn't have any Wi-Fi if it was the end of times. The only thing that would might be going still at the end of the times is terrestrial radio. And that's what a terrestrial radio is there for, is for emergency times.
We can do alt pop repeat. We need to be, hey guys, thanks for tuning in to alt pop repeat.
100%. If I am in a bunker, that's what we would be bringing, is our podcasting equipment so that we could podcast in terrestrial radio and somehow, you know, set it, because you can set it up and then we get a tune in station where we'd be like, hey, it's alt pop repeat 24/7. And people are like, no, that's how we die. Listening to Chrissy and Marie 24/7 on fucking repeat.
We're like 24/7.
Some people, that's like their hell. Some people, that's their heaven.
There's at least, I know,
on purgatory,
our,
whatever.
Well, I mean, if you look at our Clubhouse group, there's at least 118 people.
That's true. Good plug.
Now you know that we have alt pop repeat has a group on Clubhouse. We can discuss bunkers. We can discuss the end of days. We'd love to hear. I know, I'd be really curious. Anybody who's listening to this wants to put in a message to us to share us their, what's in their bug out bag.
Yep.
Will be the 5 things they take into the bunker with them. Or just, you know, would you rather an underwater bunker or an underground bunker?
Let us know.
Let us know. Get any of those Instagram 3 questions, just I'll tell pop. Us anything.
I'll pop. Repeat. So
we've got,
let's look at different types of
end of day scenarios.
So one that's really popular that we see in pop culture that has mixed between the horror world, but mainly there's lots of talk about it in apocalypse shows and things like that, is zombie culture. So we've seen the resurgence of zombie culture through apocalypse times in movies, books, TV shows, and it's always associated with the end of the world. So there actually is something called a zombie survival kit that does exist. It's called a Zero Kit. Yep. Crazy.
I've heard about Zero Kits. I zombie apocalypse is my least favorite of, like, whatever. There's like 13 different end of day scenarios, the popular end of day scenarios. Some are more obscure than others, but zombies are like my least favorite.
Well, it could actually happen. We look at things that...
Stop it.
It's not that they could be... There could be different type of zombies, right? That doesn't mean that a zombie comes from the Walking Dead. Right, but it doesn't mean that they're dead. Other zombies could be something that they take...
Like 28 days later and they all have...
Right, you end up having like a mass pandemic that ends up happening and everybody ends up taking, or some type of, I don't know, gas is leaked or something happens and people become like zombies because they've breathed it in and then it starts to affect their body. So like that's actually more plausible than the Walking Dead, than like a Frankenstein kind of zombie.
Okay, let's guess what's in a Zero Kit. A gun, because you can't have any close range stuff with a zombie, because then you are putting yourself at risk of becoming a zombie.
Yep. I actually was looking this up. There is a tactical watch that goes into the zombie kit.
What's in it? What's a tactical watch?
A tactical watch, I imagine, probably has a compass. It probably has some other type of like GPS abilities that helps you from like, tells you where you're going, probably to like how, what the temperature's like. I don't know. I'm imagining has something. Then there's something called a zombie stopper red dot holographic sight. I don't even know what the hell that is.
Zombie stopper holographic sight. That's a sight that's going to fit on top of your gun. That's what it is.
Is that what that is?
Yeah. So it projects, like, it's going to, here you go, optics plant. Let's click on the link. But it's a site. It's a site for your gum.
Here you go.
I just think it's funny that they're like, here's a zombie stopper. I'm like, people are deep into you.
Well, and that's the whole thing, is this apocalypse culture and mixed in with zombies has now become like realistic, where people can go and buy these kits if they think it's going to happen. Apparently there's a gun cleaning system in the Zero kit.
This whole thing is guns.
There's a rifle scope.
It's a gun. It's a gun.
It's a gun bag.
It's a gun bag with a watch. Okay.
And a knife. There's the apocalypse knife. The Browning zombie apocalypse knife. There's zombie practice targets in there. Look at that.
I think that this looks like, I don't know how practical it is, because really the zombie bug out bag includes just guns. Now, I do think it's really important that when you're considering different end of day scenarios that there is a way that zombie apocalypses, alien invasions, all of these things are depicted in film and television. It's a part of our sci-fi folklore. In many ways, I think the concept or the way that we think about end of days is both shaped by the wars that we as humans have lived through, the World War One, World War Two, Cold War.
Yep.
It is something that has been generationally passed down in order to be prepared. And I also think it's a function of sci-fi. And so when they're showing us like zombie apocalypses, quite often it's like Dawn of the Dead, where they go to the mall and they stay there. Now, if there's a zombie apocalypse and the dead are rising, they're going to go smell out the living and go and eat you, because that's what they do. Don't stop moving. You always got to keep on moving. Don't stop. Don't go to a mall and hole up there, because you were never going to get out.
Marie's zombie advice: do not go to a mall.
No.
When there's a zombie apocalypse,
you got to keep moving.
Don't shop.
Don't shop. Get the fuck out of town. Get in your car, get in whatever and go. Like, you've got to look at each one has a different thing. Like the pandemic.
Also slow and fast zombies. There's just two different types of zombies.
The zombies are going to move in. So if you stay comfy cozy at home, they're going to come knocking on that door at some point. And when they all come and they surround your house, where are you going to go? You got to get out. That's why you got to get moving.
Well, there's different reasons why. There's different catastrophes that you would call them that happen. And there's a subgroup of people that from this subculture has created another subgroup as well.
The zombie subculture?
No, not just in general, a prepper community. So the prepper community is a subculture on its own and now has another subculture in the subculture.
What are they?
They're called Black Survivalists.
Oh, yeah.
So BuzzFeed did a whole piece on their Follow This show where it talks about the different types of Black Survivalists. And so there's different levels or areas. There is the city Black Survivalist, and just in general, the city survivalist, and how they prep for major city catastrophes. And then there's like the country prepper. And that country prepper has like something more larger, like a zombie bag, and is living in the country and creating like little prepper areas or practicing out there. But the reason why the prepper community started and this Black survivalist community started was because of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Yeah. And so that was a big reason why, because the Black community was immensely dispersed in all different areas because of it. And they weren't prepared for it. And they were affected hard. So when that happened, a lot of communities with like people within the Black community came together and started creating the Black survivalist groups.
I do have a clip, though, that I wanted to pop in.
Bullseye. Close enough.
That's thrilling. So when did you get involved in survivalism as a lifestyle habit or choice?
It was in my 30s where I thought, you know, I probably should get back to my roots and start preparing. Right after Katrina, I started taking it seriously because of the fact that people were suffering and not prepared. And I said, that's not gonna be me. And so that's where Afrovivalist comes in, to help encourage people of color to start preparing and to teach them what they need to do to survive. Because a lot of us think our government is gonna take care of us. And I'm like, no, don't think that.
Yeah, as a function of feeling like underrepresented, misrepresented, and overlooked, which was exactly what happened during Katrina, like there is still much of New Orleans that has not yet recovered after Hurricane Katrina. And then like it can't just, there's like other parts of the world that are like Puerto Rico was impacted by same similar things. Like it's also sadly within the realm of the United States. So I get it when you go into in the scenario where it's like, hey, here we are, we live, we exist, we're a community, we're thriving. Then the hurricane, well, I won't say that necessarily everybody was thriving, but they're doing well. Hurricane hits, people's homes are demolished, they're out of work, it's a bad scene, and they need support, and the government completely abandons them, and they need to come together as a community to fix what they used to be able to rely, or they think they could rely on the systems in order to support them. But yet, here we go. Here's another opportunity in which the powers that be are failing swaths of the population.
Yeah, and they say that there's FEMA, which is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Totally looked that up. Said that people should be prepared to be on their own for more than 72 hours. That's where we're at right now when you look at North America, because maybe not as much Canada, but in the States, they're living in areas that have tornadoes, hurricanes.
Yeah.
Multiple different types of disasters that can happen. So this keeps happening over and over and over again, where massive catastrophes are happening. So they say that less than 50% of the population in the United States is not prepared for a doomsday situation.
That I believe entirely. There's just like, I think that we also need to look at some of it is just not even helping out. Like you have, you're talking, my brain was going to like indigenous communities in Canada that don't even have clean drinking water.
Right.
There's no clean drinking water. They don't have access to the same services as we do in urban centers. And that quite often they're just like left alone. And then I started thinking about water, like Flint, Michigan, do they still have dirty water? They're not being supported.
I don't know if it's been supported or not. I think the last thing I've heard, they're doing something about it now in the past couple of years, but I don't know.
It's a good question. Because for years, Flint had to survive and they had not had their pipes replaced. And so they had dirty water.
Yeah.
So again, like we have to take a look at the social and political context is that are paving the way for preppers to come into existence, is that it represents having an under, like your faith in the systems are being undermined. Therefore, you need to take accountability as an individual to ensure that you and the people that you care for are going to be taken care of, because the U.S. government might not do, the Canadian government might not fix your water.
Well, they're saying right now that's what FEMA's saying. Be prepared now in 72 hours. And as we start to have more people and more things start happening, it's going to be longer and longer periods of time that you'll get help. So it's not going to be 72 hours. It could be a week. It could be months. It could be years. It could be never.
Yeah.
We are in our sixth extinction period right now. And it's called the push pulse theory of extinction. So they're saying that within the end of this era, that we'll lose more than half our species on Earth right now. So we are coming, because there's halls of extinctions, right? And we are coming to one of those hallways now and coming closer to the end of it, not to scare the crap out of anybody, but that's what they're saying. So the more that, and it will happen at some point, we are going to become extinct. It's just the way it happens. You know, we can't, humans are not going to go on forever. Civilization will pass. We just don't know when. And so the idea of these people are saying that they want to prepare so that they can go on.
Yeah, they because I mean, you're not prepping for your entire community. That's what the government is there for. If you are being a prepper, you're doing it for your individual.
But these communities are prepping though for themselves, and they are creating sub communities where you can live now, like the Vivos community within South Dakota. AVS? But there's they're communities that have come together so that they can have their own community when something does happen, that they'll be able to restart the population or help again and do it with their immediate family, which sounds kind of awkward when you have to repopulate with your immediate family.
Why we're gonna have adjacent doors.
Well that's why. And they also, like, 575 people can stay there. So you imagine if there is Armageddon and then these are the 575 people that have to repopulate North America or the world. Like, it's probably, some are not going to live through this. So you're hoping that maybe you get 100 out of it, I would imagine. I don't know. Like, it's a sad thought, but it's true. Not everyone's going to make, not all the 575 are going to make it in the ice.
Well, I mean, one thing that is really abundantly clear here is that I'm all for, like, the underground living scenario. I am all for it. Let's do it. But when you're going into that condo, everybody needs to bring in a skill. Everybody needs to bring in a task. We need to pool our resources together. So I'm not saying, like, I'm on team. Let's get, I get my five people in. They're going to be different than your five people, Chrissy. Everybody else is going to come in. If you want to join our team, I guess our bunker team, gotta let us know what you're going to bring to the table, guys, because we're not just letting anybody in.
No. So go to @allpoprepeat on Instagram, and underneath the show, when you see that it goes live, tell us what you would bring to the bunker.
Yeah. Or join us on Clubhouse and tell us what you then bring to the bunker. We want to hear your bunker stories.
Yes.
And yeah, with that, I would basically just put out a call for people to join our team. I don't know where else we can go with this besides saying thank you so much for listening to the show. And until next time.
Yeah. Don't forget to go to allpoprepeat.com. Follow us on all social media.
Alt pop repeat. All one word. All platforms. There we are. What? Oh, and if you want to give us money, we will take it.
Yes.
So go and check us out on patreon.com/altpoprepeat.
Yep.
And let us know. And please join our club on Clubhouse, because that's like the new hip place that we're chilling these days. You might hear us talking about random topics. We might just open a room and just have a conversation about our favorite bunker decor. I'm sure that's a thing.
100%. Until then,
we love you very much.
Bye.
Bye.